It's in the book, but I can read you the poem, the original one. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
This is a near-death experience I had when I was 15. It's called The Concrete River. We sink into the dust, Baba and me, beneath brush of prickly leaves, ivy strangling trees, singing our last rites of locura. Homeboys worshiping God fumes at its break hands. Our backs press up against a corrugated steel fence along the dried banks of a concrete river, spray-painted outpourings on walls offer a chaos of color for the eyes. Home for now, hidden in weeds, furnished with stained mattresses and plastic milk crates. Wood planks thrust into thick branches serve as roof. The door is a torn cloth curtain knocked before entering. Home for now, sandwiched in between the maddening days. We aim spray into paper bags, suckle them, take deep breaths, and echo steel sounds grates the sky. Home for now, along an urban spawn stream of muck, we gargle in the technicolored synthesized madness. This river, this concrete river, becomes a steaming, bubbling snake of water, pouring over nightmares of wakefulness, pouring out a rush of birds, a flow of clear liquid on a cloudless day. Not like the black oil stains we lay in, not like the factory air engulfing us, not this plastic death in a can. Sun rays dance on the surface, gray fish fidget below the sheen, and us looking like Huckleberry Finns, Tom Sawyers with stick fishing poles as dew drips off low branches as if it was Earth's breast milk. Oh, we should be Noahs of our born days. We should be scraping wet dirt with calloused toes. We should be flowering petals playing ball. Soon, water fists do wane into a pulsating whiteness. I enter a tunnel of circles, swimming around a glare of lights. Family and friends call to me. I want to be there in perpetual dreaming, in the din of exquisite screams. I want to know this mother comfort surging through me. I am a sliver of blazing ember entering a womb of brightness. I am a hovering specter shedding scarred flesh. I am a clown sneaking out of painted mouth in the sky. I am your son, Ama, seeking the security of shadows, fleeing weary eyes bursting brown behind a sewing machine. I am your brother, the one you tore through off rooftops, tore into with rage, the one you visited, a rag of a boy lying in a hospital bed, ruptured. I am friend of books, prey of cops, lover of the body of women, selling hamburgers and tacos at the P&G burger stand. I welcome this heavy shroud. I want to be buried in it, to be sculptured marble and craftier hands. Soon an electrified hum sinks teeth into brain, then claws surround me, pull at me, back to the dust, to the concrete river. Let me go to stay entangled in this mesh of barbed serenity, but over me is a face, mouth breathing back life. I feel the gush of air, the pebbles and debris beneath me. Give me the bag, man, I slur. No way. You died, man, Baba said. You stopped breathing and died. I have to go back. He don't understand. I try to get up to reach the sky. Oh, for the lights, for this whore of a sun to blind me, to entice me to burn. Come back. Let me swing in delight to the haunt and now, to pierce colors of virgin skies, not here along a concrete river, but there licked by tongues of flame.
I'm Jonathan Hirsch, and you're listening to Arrivals, stories of migration, transformation, and change.
My name is Luis Javier Rodriguez. So I was born on the border. We actually lived in Ciudad Juarez. My dad was planning to come to the United States. My dad hated the Mexican political system. He hated the PRI. He hated, you know, he was a teacher. He was a very educated man. He ran a principal. He was a principal of a high school. My mother was his secretary. And he got so much trouble, he even got jailed there. He just hated. So he wanted to come over. The problem with living in L.A. is the instability. We're constantly being thrown out of places, couldn't pay our bills. So at one point, we didn't have no gas because the gas wasn't paid, you know, so we didn't have no heat. And then my dad going crazy when he did get hired at Taft High School. I say he went crazy because he just wanted the American dream, went all out, took us to Reseda, which was not a good place in the time because it was all white. And so I got hit really hard, being chased by all the white kids, being beaten up, being bullied. I still couldn't speak the language, so it got really rough for me. But My dad thought, well, now we're living the American dream, but it was all a lie. You know, pretty soon he couldn't hang on to that job, and they got rid of him, and we lost everything, you know, because, you know, no more car, no more house, no more TV, everything. He lost everything. So we got evicted again, and my dad went to a poverty agency, and they found him a place in South San Gabriel, which became my neighborhood. That was an unincorporated, mostly migrant community of Mexicans, but it used to be white migrants like Okies and Arkies. Remember them? They in the 30s, it was their neighborhood, and they called it Wilmar because they had came from Wilmar, Arkansas. And they even had a little league place called Rebel Field because they were rebels, Confederate fam, you know what I'm saying? But Mexicans by the 40s pretty much took it over. So at the time, San Gabriel Valley was very farm oriented. I mean, in other words, there was orange groves, there was cornfields. It's hard to imagine this part of LA, especially now, a big urban area, but it was, I guess Brooklyn was like that at one point. It was, people were telling me they grew up in orange groves, and not orange groves, but cornfields and whatever. So San Gabriel Valley was like that, but the Mexicans were the migrant workers, and we were in the poorest neighborhoods. They had Hicks camps and Hayes camp out of Almani. There was Jardín, the Garden, which was another neighborhood. There was Lomas, which was my neighborhood, the hills. There was Sangre, which was all the migrant workers and railroad workers around the San Gabriel Mission. Almost all these neighborhoods had these poor Mexican neighborhoods surrounded. I don't know when they started the suburbs, but they surrounded by white suburbs that were tearing down the orange groves and tearing down the cornfields. And pretty soon we were just poor neighborhoods surrounded by nice residential white suburban communities. We lived in a one-bedroom house. So again, everybody lived in the living room except for me and my brother. They gave us the one room. And it was just poor. I mean, the house was almost like paper. I remember one time we had a little play. We were playing around, all of us, and I threw my sister against the wall, and the whole wall caved in. You know, it was just terrible. It was like little shacks. They were really shacks. The closest I could say was like when I went to Appalachia. People didn't know that LA had homes like that. It looked closer, like the Lomas was Appalachia, a smaller version of Appalachia in the San Gabriel Valley. And it was little shacks with dirt roads and ravines. There was abandoned cars and ravines. People had goats and chickens in their backyard. It was another world, again, surrounded by American residential suburban life. And so that's the contrast. And me growing up there was, this became my body or my neighborhood, and all the kids knew each other. And it was mostly Mexican, but there was remnants of the white poor kids, and so some of them were in our neighborhood too. They spoke Spanish too, just to get along with us. So it wasn't totally Mexican, but we incorporated all of them. And that was the way it was, that people can't imagine that up to the mid-80s, that's the way that neighborhood used to be, that it was that poor even then. So around 10 years old is when everything changed for me. By 10, I was pretty angry. Cops used to beat us up. To me, they were like an occupied army in my neighborhood. And I used to come home and be beaten up. And I would say the cops did this. And my mom and dad would say, well, what did you do? They wouldn't get mad if the cops did it. They would get mad at me. I didn't do anything. I'm standing in the corner. They're just slapping us around. They didn't know how it was. And they didn't defend us, you know. And so it was hard for me to go to them and say, hey, the teachers are being racist. The cops are being, they couldn't get it. They didn't want to get it. And they just felt, so you messed up. You should be quiet and don't rock no boats. You know what I'm saying? But I didn't accept that. Maybe my brothers and sisters did, but I didn't. So I was always a troublemaker. And by 10, I had a friend that died. You know, when you're 10 years old, you don't really know too much about death, really, to be honest with you. Even in that world, it wasn't something that was common to me. And the police, you know, we had just broken into the elementary school, played basketball. We were just goofing around. There was no place to play basketball, so you break in. And then the cops saw us, and they chased us. And they caught up to me, but what he ends up doing, climbs the roof, runs across, thinking he's going to get away. I don't know what he's thinking, but it's dark, so he doesn't see there's a skylight, and he falls right through and kills himself. And I could hear him falling, yelling, and I could hear the crashing. It changed my life, you know, about just, I was just so hurt because nobody asked me how I felt. Nobody asked me nothing. Nobody asked me what's going on. Nobody even questioned me. you know, it was like, it happened, so what? And I remember going to a little memorial for him. I think it might have been the funeral. It's hard to remember if it was a family thing, but nobody asked me anything. Nobody, you know, I was like, and I was kind of stunned and I was kind of angry. I didn't know where to go with that. You know, I always felt maybe a little bit more sensitive to speaking out, to having a voice. I didn't quite know it at the time, but I was always a sensitive kid. You know, I was one of those kids that rather play by myself with trucks and army men than to go out and play in the yard because I was into my head. But you know, when you're a sensitive boy, it's messed up. You know, then you're gay, then something's wrong with you, you know, and all of a sudden, so I was being attacked for things that I wasn't gay, but it didn't matter. I didn't even know what that was. They called you every name in the book because you're supposed to be out there playing, you're supposed to be tough. And I just wanted to be in my head, and that wasn't a place for me. So I learned to be tough just to get away from that because I got jumped when I was 9 years old, actually a year before that 10-year incident where they cracked my, it just cracked, it didn't break my jaw, but it, then we never got it fixed, and so there was a, like a little growth, and it forced my jaw to go completely crooked. To this day, I only have three places where my teeth meet. But when I was growing up, I looked really bad. I looked pretty ugly. I was a skinny little Mexican kid with this jaw, so I didn't have any friends. Girls made fun of me. They called me monkey, you know, and I hated it. And the only one that embraced me was, and when I was 11 years old, was the gang. They didn't care. They embraced you. And they were the only ones that said, hey, it's cool. You know, and they called me, my gang name was Chin. After a while, I was like, that was what it was. And to me, then it became like, it's cool to be ugly. It wasn't a bad thing. So you know what it was? I think it was like all the Lost Boys, we were all called together. Kind of like, and all it takes is one good leader and he would, you know, you guys are just hanging out. You're not making it in school. You're not doing too good. Nobody likes you. Come on in, then we realize we're all lost. We're all, our families aren't that good, you know what I mean? And we found each other. And then you felt this camaraderie, this kind of need to be part of something. And they embraced you, which I think makes gangs very compelling for a kid like me. Most kids didn't join gangs, by the way. They didn't need to. You know, I had a lot of emptiness in me that a gang made sense. One gang had broken through the elementary school I was in and chased all these kids and scared the teachers. They broke into the fence. They had chains and sticks and bricks, and they even had zip guns that they would make out of antennas. I was totally intrigued by it. I wasn't scared. I'm like, man, what, those guys are powerful. I want to be like them. You know, a broken down, dumb kid like me wants to be powerful because I didn't have any power. And joining the gang, to me, felt powerful and felt like I was going to be embraced. And that's very compelling to broken down kids like a lot of us were. I got initiated in the gang, which is another way they embrace you. They beat you up. They make sure that you can take it. You know, you have to learn not to cry. I became this shy, sensitive kid to this tough kid. And the way that I showed my toughness was I was the first one, you got to fight, I'm willing to fight. I wasn't a good fighter, it didn't matter. I was game. You know, knife, stab somebody, I'll do it. Shoot somebody, eventually, I'm going to do them. I started huffing, you know, all the sniffing, you know, and I got so bad at it that, I mean, I got so addicted to it that people were saying, well, now we got other drugs. And I took everything, barbiturates, you know, whites, the amphetamines, whatever they call them now. In other words, I took everything that was there. I took the mescaline, took the LSD, and then I started doing the heroin. That was part of the life. I was game to do everything. I was like so, I wanted it all, you know what I mean? And I think there was a kind of a death wish in me that I didn't know at the time. I really wanted to die, but I wanted to die like this, to die for the neighborhood, die for the gang. I didn't mind getting shot at in the street corner because I wanted to get killed. I wasn't getting killed. I got shot at half a dozen times and I never got shot. It was like just it wasn't in the cards, as they say. But I was game. And I remember one time I went to a funeral and a girl who was trying to take care of me was saying, you know, this is going to be you if you keep doing what you're doing. And, you know, I told her, man, I want a funeral just like this. I can hardly wait till I have my own funeral because it was the only place where I felt people loved you. I felt the mothers were there, the fathers show up that you never had before they show up, and all of a sudden girls that you didn't think like you are crying. I said, man, I want this. You know, that's how distorted you could look at the world, and being in the gang kind of affirms that kind of distortion. A lot of people came from good parents. They were just hardworking, completely clueless about what was going on. with this Chicano Cholo kid. They had no idea. It just doesn't come from Mexico, even though Mexican kids are doing it. It's not really from Mexico. The Pachucos connected with Mexico on the border and everything, but it really wasn't even a Mexican thing. You know what I'm saying? So my parents didn't understand. They worked really hard. My dad would get up at 4:30 in the morning and come back late, 9:30 at night. He ended up getting a job at Pierce College as a custodian. So he would come all the way from San Gabriel Valley to San Fernando Valley. It's like a big, long distance. My mom worked as a costurera, you know, working in the garment industry, or she would clean people's homes, or she just took care of us if she wasn't working. So they were good parents, but we were mostly Latsky kids. You know, they didn't come home too late, or when they were there, they were just, my mom was just frustrated. She was the one that beat us up and knocked us around. My dad didn't even bother. He was an emotionally detached person. He never said, I love you. Every once in a while, he took us places, but hardly, you know, and he was just detached. And so I didn't really have a dad, even though he was there. He never really connected. So my mom was the one that was beating us up, straightening us out. And I always loved my mom in spite of all that. But my dad, I have hardly any love for him. I just didn't connect to him. This gang was the Lost Boys, I guess, of that neighborhood. There was a guy named Bobby Rags, because he was always in rags, going to school, walking the streets. There was a whole family of guys named Noodles, Peaches, and Butter. We were just lost kids with no family. No, we didn't even have our real names, you know. And they embraced everybody's bad side. We had a short guy that was so short, we scummed Chaparro. He was shorty, you know. I had chin, you know. The guy who was so dark, we called him Negro. You know, you just embrace the parts of you that other people couldn't embrace. So I was in that group. And we were, at first, I think just hanging around. We were homies, we were drinking, but eventually older guys would come in. Can you steal bikes? Can you steal cars? They had chop shops, you know, and we were just the crew that would go, and we'd steal them and take them to places. We knew where to take certain junkyards where these guys would pay you very little for all the stuff we stole. But for us, it was money. And it became money to get drugs more than anything. At first, it was just get food because I couldn't get any food anywhere else. But I learned to just survive on hostess pies. That's all I would eat all day long and just use drugs. You know what I mean? That was really the bad thing. I really wasn't so much a drug seller. I was just a drug user. So I knew all the connections. And we would steal and mug and burglarize homes just to steal, just to get money for drugs, basically, and a little bit of junk food we can get. So it was just became a smaller crew of guys that were just like crazy enough. And my best friend was a heavily tattooed gang kid who was a street kid. Shouldn't give me the time of day, but he just loved hanging around with me because I love books. I love stories. I remember one time I eventually ended up coming back to the house. And my mom didn't want me there, so I moved into the garage. There was a little room. I cleared it up, painted murals on all the walls, and it had no heat, no running water, but it was my little room. So I was still homeless, only now I had a roof over my head. My homie would come, and we would sit outside and do like campfires, you know, and just tell stories. He loved hanging around with me. And I don't know why. This guy was a hardcore gang kid. And he eventually got killed when he was 17. But he was like my best friend because he just loved hanging around with me. And I wasn't even like him. We were two different worlds. He just loved that I was, to him, I was more stable, I guess. But it was us again in that madness. And I got pulled into, eventually at 15, I got jumped into the hardcore part of the gang, which we call the Locos.
And how did that happen?
They invite you. This is not something everybody can join because there was different clicas. You know, there's the pequeños, the small guys. There was the Dukes, which was the next group of guys. There was the Chicos, and then I was in the Chicos, and then the Locos were the hardcore guys, and they would have to invite you in. So there was a guy that says, hey, you know, I think you proved yourself. You're always game. We're going to invite you, and they beat you up. There, they really beat you up, like, for a minute or two, which is a long time. It's not really, like, short time. You know, you get beat up for a minute. It's a pretty long time. And then they would brace you and you'd be all knocked around, but they would love you. And then, of course, heroin became a big deal. I was already using heroin. I mean, you start by sniffing, you start by, you know, skin popping, you know, then and the muscle, and then eventually you do it intravenously. So now it became quite a part of the culture. But the other thing is we did high-end jobs then. I mean, hijacking We would go to all the truck stops up and down the 10 freeway, all the way up to the desert. You know, we would do high-end robberies, high-end jobs, bank robberies, big convenience stores or little convenience stores, actually. You know, big burglaries. It was high-end work that was being done. And I was game, but the main thing was the drive-by shootings. We were doing all these drive-by shootings. So I got involved with that and even firebombing people's homes. You know, it was just, it was a more violent, more crazy end of La Vida Loca that I got pulled into. Some people were game, some people were not. There's a lot of goofy-ass guys, I hate to say that, and there's also guys that didn't have the courage. So there was certain people you could trust, and they would call you in. Are you game? You want to do this? You know how to get a gun? You got a gun? We can get you a gun? Okay. You know, I was stupid, I think, doing things. And I even remember stabbing somebody with a rusty screwdriver because somebody told me to do it, because that's just to prove myself. Am I tough enough? I'm not. It's not in my nature, really. I had to detach myself just to do that. I couldn't even hear the person screaming. I couldn't even see who he was. You know how it is. You just emotionally, you're like in a cloud. You're like in a void there. And I had to put myself in that place just to do some of these things. And then drive-bys are easy because you don't have to see the people you're shooting. I just have to say, they're your enemies. Just shoot them. You know what I mean? You're detached completely. Started going to jail at 13 for stealing, you know, for disturbing the peace, for fighting. Ended up in jails. And then at 16, I was arrested for murder. I was in murder's row. Eventually, they found out that they couldn't really get me for them, so I got released. And a year later, I was arrested for attempted murder, in which four people were shot. I shot one of them, you know, but other people shot other people. But then the homies scared all the witnesses, and I got let go of that. I was in juvenile hall for that. And I was getting away with almost everything until about 18. At 18, everything kind of came to a head. I was in the street, and once I was in the street, I was incorrigible, I couldn't be controlled. But my saving grace was this crazy, imaginative world I was in, so I used to love to read books. That's what saved me. I loved going to libraries. I loved to have books of my own. Even when I was homeless, I would sleep in abandoned cars or cubby holes in the LA River and just have books, you know. I never slept with other people or near other groups. I never had went to encampments with them. I always slept in different parts, every different place every night. I didn't trust anybody, you know. But mainly because I was embarrassed that I loved to read books. And so that was my world. And that kind of saved me, I think, because I would spend hours in that downtown library when I was down there. There's an abyss that you fall into with heroin and with this gang life that at a certain point I also didn't want to go through. I could see what people were willing to do for heroin. I could see how far they were willing to go. And there's a point in me, and maybe it's because somewhere along the line, maybe I remember what my parents taught me. I don't know. I couldn't fall completely there. I stopped myself. What happened is I got arrested again. But this time they were going to try to give me my first prison term, state prison term. What I did something that was uncharacteristic of a good gangster. I was at an after-hours club. I was on heroin, drinking, and pills. I used to mix all this stuff up. And cops were beating up. It was about eight cops beating up on this young Mexican girl who was handcuffed on the ground, already screaming and yelling. She couldn't move. They were beating her up there. Everybody was walking away. And I just felt compelled to not. Got attractive to the Chicano movement. I got attracted to the movement of people that were trying to protest social justice. I used to read in the libraries Black Panther books, you know, Elders Cleaver to James Baldwin to George Jackson. I read every book, Malcolm X, like one of my favorite books, because there wasn't Chicano books, but I could still relate to them. All those things kind of got me to think, I don't really want to be a gangster. I want to be something else. I didn't know exactly what. But when I saw that girl being beaten up, I stood up for her. And, of course, it got me. I didn't get it. They said I assaulted police officers. I didn't get to touch any of them. They jumped on me and beat the hell out of me and ended up taking me around several times before they took me to the substation, beat me up as I was going around. And I remember kind of in my head saying, they ain't going to break me. But I thought I was saying it out loud. I wasn't. I was just keeping it all in my head. They were beating me up, and I was, they ain't going to break me. You know, it was that kind of thing. And so I was already prepared to be a different person. And once you're, once I was in the county jail, and again, I, the police wanted me to go prison. They were clamoring. I had community people that stepped up for me. This is when I knew that maybe people cared. I had a mentor who worked really hard to get letters on my behalf. He got some people to show up in court. The judge really got impressed with this because most people don't show up with anybody, not even their family sometimes. And I was already 18, so there was no juvenile. My family wasn't going to show up. I had no homies, no family. So it was just him and whoever he could muster. But the judge got impressed. And so he gave me time served in the county jail for resisting arrest and disorderly conduct, something like that, drunken disorderly, which was I could do in the county jail, which I did. And then I was trying to leave heroin there, and which was, I didn't realize how bad I had gotten because it was so painful. I had guys there in the jail helping me get clean. And so to me, it was like my first step to change my life. And so when I when the judge finally gave me a break, because I thought I was going to do state prison term. I was prepared to do state prison term as a Chicano revolutionary there. But when he gave me a break, I realized I can't look back now. I couldn't be on drugs, and I couldn't be on crime, and I couldn't really be in the violence. I really began to turn against this violence that we were doing to each other. I saw it as part of the system's way of controlling us. I mean, my mentor helped me realize that I was an artist and a writer. I didn't know I was. That I had dropped out of school for like a year and a half, but he got me back to high school. They always thought us Cholas were dumb, but I wasn't dumb. I actually got my high school diploma because I did all my work. I got all my units. In those days, there was no GED. I think you had to get all your units by 18, otherwise you couldn't get a diploma. I got them all done. They were surprised how smart I was. I was really smart, and a lot of gangsters were. And I was able to get my diploma. I never went cap and gown because I was got it too late, but they gave it to me in the principal's office, and it was an achievement for me. I even tried to go to college. I didn't make it, but I tried. You know? In other words, I was expanding my horizons, and that to me was important. Books became, it used to be like my curse and blessing. Now it's more of a blessing. I got involved with the radical wing of the Chicano movement, where we would study Marxism, we would study other cultural phenomena in other parts of the world, we study economy. This is high-level stuff. I ate it up, man. And my home and my friend would say, you know, you were the angriest and the hungriest of all the guys. And when I said, I couldn't have been the angriest, there's some raging fools in my neighborhood. No, he says, you were the angriest against injustice, and you were the hungriest for something new. I don't want that life. I want another life. And I never did look back. Not that I didn't have issues. I had rage issues. I had drinking. I drank for 20 years after I let go of the drugs. I had other issues, but I was done with that part of the world. And what I did, though, to make up for some stuff, is I decided to dedicate myself to community service. It's like no judge did that. I did that myself. To work in the community, help other people. I went to prisons. By age 25, I was going to prisons, and I've been going to prisons ever since to work with guys that didn't make it. I go to juvenile halls. I talk to kids. I go to high schools. You know, I go all over the world actually doing this work. And so to me, it was just my way of giving back, because I don't want to excuse that I hurt people, that I've stabbed people, that I've shot people. I don't want to excuse that I did some terrible things. I robbed people. It's like restorative justice, but on my own terms. I'm transforming the world from the world that I was caught up in and that I did some bad things for. And I'm willing to acknowledge it, but I'm also willing to say that I'm never going to go back to that world. I just want to help change the environment that created that world in the first place. That's kind of like where I'm at.
Special thanks to the Poet Laureate of Los Angeles, Luis Rodriguez, for sharing his story. You can read about Luis's life in his memoir, Always Running. And I'd like to say a personal thank you to Luis for the book of poems. It's on my bedside table at this very moment. Today's episode was produced by me with a ton of help from our associate producer, Nora Lind. Thank you, Nora. And episode art, as always, comes from the amazing Steph Tan. Arrivals is a part of the Herd Audio Collective. And you can hear all about the Herd shows by visiting the link in the show notes of this episode or by checking out our website, ARRVLS.com. I'm Jonathan Hirsch. Thank you, as always, for listening. And until we meet again, may you wind up where you need to be.
As we cooked, shared wine, and told stories of Hainas and the Little Conquest, a fight for honor homies in the hood, a gray Mercury sedan with its headlights turned off crept up the road. Wheeler was the closest up the slope to the street. He looked over at the Mercury, then frowned. "Anybody recognize the Ranfla?" Wheeler inquired. "Chale," Chicharron responded. "It looks too funky to be gangbangers, unless that's what they want it to look like." Wheelo moved up the slope from the field, followed by Clavo, Chicharron, and Little Man. Fernie stayed back with Noodles and me. Wheelo and Clavo were the first ones to hit the street as the Mercury delayed a turn around a curve. Clavo moved to one side of the Mercury, its occupants covered in darkness. He stretched out his arms and yelled out, "Here stand the animal tribe, Ike." The Mercury stopped. A shadow stepped out of the bastion side door, a sawed-off shotgun in his hands. Another shadow pushed an automatic rifle out the side window. "Sangre Diablos, que rifa," the dude with the shotgun yelled out. Then a blast snapped at the night air. Wheelo and Chicharron fell back down the slope. Automatic gunfire followed as they rode in the dirt. The bullets skimmed off tree branches, knocked over trash cans, and ricocheted off walls. Wheelo ended up face down. Chicharron landed on his butt. Noodles knelt behind the sofa whimpering. The cracking sound stopped. The Mercury sped off, its tires throwing up dirt and pebbles behind it. I could see the car speeding down another hill. I ran up the slope, slipping and sliding toward the road. On the street, Little Man kneeled over Clavo, who lay sprawled on the ground and trembling. Half of Clavo's face was shot full of pellets, countless black steaming round holes, his eyes dripping into the dirt.
Thanks for listening to this podcast, which is brought to you by Acast. Like you, millions of people enjoy podcasts every week. Acast works with thousands of amazing shows, reaching the most engaged, loyal, and desirable audiences on demand. For more information about advertising, sponsorship, and branded content opportunities for your business, contact us using sponsor@acast.com.